This series contains adult language and depictions of graphic violence. Listener discretion is advised. About 30 miles southwest of Chicago, just over the state line, sits the once thriving city of Gary, Indiana. Rising from the sand along the southern tip of Lake Michigan, the city of Gary was founded in the year 1906 and named after attorney Albert Gary, who happened to be the founding chairman of the United States Steel Corporation, or commonly known as U.S. Steel. When you're the founder of a company that builds a city around a steel mill that promises jobs and affluence for the residents, well, I guess they name the city after you. Welcome back to The Devil Within. You're listening to The House of Demons. Since its founding, the city of Gary has really been through the ringer. There were terrible riots in 1919 between striking steel workers and men looking to take their jobs. Things got so bad that martial law was declared in the city and thousands of National Guard troops were needed to restore order. Then in 1968, during the Holy Week Uprising, which was civil unrest that spread across the country in the wake of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., the National Guard was again required to restore the peace, along with a ban on alcohol and gasoline sales, because there were 15 reported firebombings. But it wasn't always a riot in Gary. In 1958, the King of Pop himself, Michael Jackson, was born at the corner of 23rd and Jackson Street. And then there's also, you know, all the steel that helped build America. Because for decades, U.S. Steel's Gary Works plant was the largest steel mill in the world, with an annual production capacity of 8.2 million tons. During World War II, the Gary Works made the steel that helped win the war, plain and simple. Their steel went to everything from tanks and airplanes to helmets and ammunition. After the war, steel that was produced in America accounted for fully 40% of the global demand, and a big chunk of that came straight out of Gary. By 1970, the city had traded its nickname of the Magic City for an even grander one, the City of the Future. But no one could tell that disaster was right around the corner. The American steel industry began to crater, and massive layoffs at the Gary Works soon followed. While many people blamed the economy or the fall in global demand for American steel, honest people will tell you that racism played the biggest role in the stunning decline of the proud city of Gary, Indiana. You see, when the jobs left, the people who could afford to move to a new town to follow the jobs were mostly white upper middle class. Many in the African American community simply couldn't afford to just pull up stakes and resettle in a new town. And to make matters worse, the nice houses left behind by the people abandoning Gary were out of reach to those who stayed behind, because the banks wouldn't lend them money to purchase those homes. As of today, more than 20% of all structures in Gary are abandoned and in serious states of disrepair and neglect. Where there were once almost 180,000 residents in the 1960s, there are fewer than 70,000 today. The Magic City became the murder capital of America, and the City of the Future became the most miserable city in the United States. When a local resident was asked to explain this, the reply was, quote, "Well, at least we're not the murder capital anymore, because there's no one left to be murdered. And there's not much crime at all, really. No drugs, because you need money to buy drugs, and there's no money here. Plus, there isn't even anything left to steal that you could sell." In the fall of 2011, the Ammons family moved into a tidy one-story home on Carolina Street in Gary. Latoya Ammons and her three children, along with her mother, Rosa Campbell, were looking for a fresh start, and they hoped this house was the beginning of a new phase in all of their lives. Latoya had three children The boys were ages 7 and 9, and she had a 12-year-old girl. They were all friendly and outgoing, did well in school, and all family members were active in their local church. Things seemed to be going their way, finally. Until a few days later, when the family noticed that a swarm of black flies had congregated on the screen of their front door. It was almost winter, definitely not fly season. And no matter how they swatted them, shooed them away, sprayed them, they kept coming back. Then Latoya's oldest child, a girl, asked to have a friend sleep over. That was when the terror kicked into high gear. That night, as she lay sleeping in her bed, Latoya's daughter began to levitate high above the sheets. Alarmed, her friend immediately notified the grown-ups, and soon both Latoya and Rosa were at the girl's bedside in complete shock and at a loss as to what to do next. They did the only thing they could think of. They knelt in prayer and asked their God for help.
I was very frightened. I knew I was up against something supernatural. I knew it wasn't anything of this world. I knew it was only one way to fight it, and that was with God.
It was hours they knelt and prayed beside the bed of their 12-year-old, who was serenely floating unconscious above it all. Eventually, through the power of their prayer, they claimed they were able to defeat whatever evil force was briefly in control of the young girl. But that same evening, Rosa, having been spooked by what she just saw, admitted to having heard footsteps every night coming from the back basement staircase. And even more recently, she had encountered what she described as a shadow man wandering the house.
One of the demons started, his image started coming in full. Like, we would see them, but we would see, you know, like
shadows.
The shadows, like the ghostly look of them.
Not a shadow of a man projected onto the wall or on the floor, but a man who was actually a shadow. That was his form, just wispy darkness. And what's more, he left a footprint in the kitchen. The next morning, the girl had no memory of the incident, but her friend had decided not to sleep over. For now, whatever evil force was present in that house, it would leave the girl alone. But it would focus on her little brothers.
It was throwing my children around. We would grab the children and we would anoint them with olive oil and claim the blood of Jesus. And we would pray over them, praises out of Psalms. And they would flee. They would get off of the children. The children would, you know, become themselves again.
As stated, the boys were 7 and 9 years old, and the Ammon brothers were your typical pre-adolescents, looking for trouble, innocent yet curious, just adventurous mama's boys. But soon, they were speaking in low, guttural voices. Their eyes would frequently roll back in their heads, and they would, allegedly, walk on the ceiling. Then on March 10th, 2012, things escalated, and one specific event was witnessed by non-family members. There was a gathering at the Ammons family home to mourn the loss of a loved one. This gathering was attended by several friends from the community. There was a disturbance from the room where Latoya's daughter was resting, and several people rushed in to offer assistance. Instead, they witnessed the 12-year-old girl again levitating above her bed, just as she had months earlier.
Nobody would come back.
No one, no friends, no family wanted to come around. And, you know, we understood because it was scary. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we felt alone, hurt, lost, and we had no one to depend on but the Lord. Mm-hmm. So we stayed strong, kept our faith strong, and, you know, we became so strong that we decided to just fight him. It was do or die. It's either you fight or you die. Very violent. It picked up a lamp from out of my bedroom and threw it into the living room. It was throwing chairs. They were throwing chairs. Oh yeah, it picked up like air freshener cans, threw the can. Everything was happening all at once. So we grabbed some clothes and grabbed what we could, and we ran out of the house. As we was running out of the house, it picked my oldest son up and threw him off the porch.
Flipped him over.
It flipped him over and threw him off the porch.
And again, the incident resolved itself through prayer in the form of mother and grandmother holding vigil at the bedside. But soon the effects of the spirits in the house would become too much to handle. The boys would frequently be heard speaking with a child who simply wasn't there, as well as issuing threats from a trance-like state, including, "It's time to die," and "I will kill you." LaToya and Rosa suspected demonic possession and sought help from their church, but they were turned away. No one would take their claims seriously. They finally managed to find a few people who offered some advice. Cleanse the house spiritually by using ammonia and vinegar, as well as using oil to draw crosses on all doors and windows. A clairvoyant also did a reading on the property and determined that at least 200 demons had taken up residence. The boys were so affected by the events in the house that they were missing a substantial amount of school, to the point where city agencies began to involve themselves, including law enforcement as well as doctors from the Division of Child Services. And it's here that the story of the Ammons' possession takes a unique turn, because there would be additional witnesses to bona fide paranormal activity at a government level. Under the supervision of DCS, one of LaToya's sons was taken to be examined by their family doctor, who was quick to note massive and potentially dangerous behavioral changes in the boy. Changes he couldn't explain. And then, witnessed by both the doctor and the supervising DCS administrators, the boy did something truly remarkable.
Well, let me ask you this. You've got a police captain saying he believes. Did you interview the people who claim to have seen the boy walking backwards up the wall?
That's right. He was launched across the room and walked up the wall backwards. Now, yes, such incredible claims have been made before and will be made again when it comes to demonic possession. But this was the first that we know about that was witnessed by healthcare professionals who were willing to go on the record with their story.
I interviewed the registered nurse who witnessed or says he witnessed the boy walking backward up the wall. I did not interview the Department of Child Services caseworker. However, I had her report from that incident.
And did she claim to see it as well?
She claimed to see it as well, yes.
Do you have any reason to doubt their accounts? I mean, as a reporter, you always go in skeptical.
Even the mainstream national media picked it up.
Factor follow-up segment tonight. Last night, we told you about a 9-year-old Indiana boy who apparently was doing some very shocking things, so much so that exorcism was involved. The Indianapolis Star, that state's biggest newspaper, is heavily covering the story, and a captain in the Gary, Indiana Police Force, Charles Austin, says the situation is credible. That is incredible.
As a precaution, and to get them back in school, the children were removed from the Ammons house until everything could be sorted out. Meanwhile, the police were tasked with a thorough examination of the house to determine what, if anything, was causing all the mayhem.
One time, she woke up in the middle of the night, maybe like 3 in the morning, and they saw this shadowy figure pacing back and forth in the living room.
And I saw one, like, coming into full image. It was coming out of my closet. I've never seen it like that before.
Whenever you would praise God in Latin, no reaction. But you start condemning the demon, you know, condemning, you know, the evil spirit, you know, all of a sudden she's reacting to that.
Demons can actually possess you, use you, so you can give them souls, you know, and they make you take your own life. you know, so.
While nothing jumped out at them, both literally or figuratively, the police did encounter some less than ordinary occurrences. Radio malfunctions, maybe a whispering voice from the darkness. One officer even claimed to see a, quote, smoky apparition out of the corner of his eye. Sounds kind of like the Shadow Man. The alleged source of the haunting, the back basement steps, were even demolished and the ground beneath them excavated to search for possible signs of an ancient graveyard, the rationale being that perhaps there were unsettled souls that decided to make themselves known. But nothing was found. LaToya Ammons needed help. Her children had been taken away. Her house seemed haunted, and she thought that herself, as well as her mother Rosa, were possessed by one or more of the demons that had slowly ruined her life. Enter Father Michael Maginot, a local priest who familiarized himself with the plight of the Ammons family and offered his assistance.
Joining us now from Chicago, Father Michael Maginot, Catholic priest, who has been dealing with the situation. So, Father, I want to keep this fact-based, what you know, what you saw, what you did. Let's start with the boy. What do you know about him?
Actually, I have never met any of the children. The first time I heard about the incident was when, just after the boy walked up the wall backwards, there was a furor there, people running out, calling for the police, security, the chaplain. He called me. I was in my parish conducting a Bible study class, and I got the call because I was on call for the Catholic priest chaplain who was off at that time, and they called me in to do an exorcism. And
I said, "Let me stop you there. Exorcism is a very rare and serious thing that the Catholic Church, and you have to go through a lot of hoops to get it approved, to get the people in." It disturbs me a little bit that the boy involved, and this is according to the newspaper and other eyewitnesses, you know, was doing incredible things like walking up walls and things like that. But you yourself never talked to the boy. Why not?
Well, when I went to do the interview at the home with the mother and the grandmother, it was a 4-hour interview. And the first 2 hours were basically just getting information of all the occurrences and phenomena that was surrounding everything leading up to that incident at the emergency room in the hospital.
The problem I'm having with this is, number one, you didn't see the boy. I think the credibility of the Catholic Church is in a tough way now in this country. Exorcism is a very serious thing. Very, very serious. Mm-hmm. I understand you got permission from the bishop in your diocese to do this. But it just seems to me that the story is not solid enough to go public with it. And there are a lot of people watching right now that say this is more mumbo jumbo from the Roman Catholic Church and no credibility here at all. How would you answer that?
Well, the boys, the two boys and the girl, were one was put into a lockdown psychological children's ward, and the other two were taken to the Carmelite sisters who take care of foster children. And so they were taken away from the parents and from the mother and the grandmother, and so I didn't have access to them. And I discovered in the investigation that the mother was also possessed, mainly at the end, very end. I put the crucifix on her forehead and she began to convulse.
As a Catholic priest for many years, you believe that there is something unworldly involved with this family. You do believe that? All right, Father.
Yeah, I do.
I'm going to stop it there, and we appreciate your time.
Ordained as a priest in the Gary Archdiocese in 1983, Father Maginot knew he could help. Now, although the father claims to have had permission from the Bishop of Gary, the Archdiocese denies that claim. They issued the following statement on their website. Reverend Michael Maginot, a priest of the Diocese of Gary, has no authority or permission from the Bishop of Gary to perform exorcisms. Under Church Law, Canon 1172, such special and express permission for exorcism is required. Reverend Maginot is not permitted to engage in related aspects of this ministry, nor should he be presented as an authority in such matters. If members of the faithful believe they need spiritual assistance, they should contact their pastor, who may then make a further referral if necessary. Nonetheless, Father Maginot performed 3 different exorcisms on LaToya, all while trying to diagnose what had led to her condition. Now, it's here that Maginot learned that LaToya had been seeing a boyfriend, and whenever he asked LaToya about this man, strange things would happen in the house, things that he witnessed, blinds suddenly swinging, lights flickering. So he investigated further. It turns out that this boyfriend had asked LaToya for personal items, including a family picture that he could keep. And also, Maginot learned, this man was married to another woman. The father suspected that a curse had been placed on LaToya, and although he couldn't prove it, he would design his method of care around that assumption. The first exorcism was wholly unsuccessful. Demons, the father explained, can sometimes trick you into thinking you've gotten rid of them, only to find out later that they've only gotten stronger. Such was the case with LaToya. So Father Maginot did his homework and was able to determine the names of the demons possessing LaToya and tailor his next exorcism to specifically battle one of them. And it worked. Now, only one demon remained, and LaToya asked if Maginot would conduct this next rite in Latin. The father agreed and went to work. And now this demon was not as willing to depart the body of LaToya, and Father Maginot feared the worst until he decided to write the name of the demon on a piece of paper, and while going through the rites of exorcism, he lit the piece of paper on fire. LaToya suddenly fell into a deep sleep, and when she awoke, she no longer had any aversion to holy relics and was soon back to her normal self. It wasn't long before LaToya was reunited with her children, and the family had moved to a new place in Indianapolis. And in the more than 10 years since the alleged demonic possession of herself, her children, and their house, no one in the family has reported any further incidents. As for the house, TV producer Zach Baggins purchased the property as a filming location for a documentary on the subject. The film ended with the demolition of the house. However, several pieces of the basement foundation were saved to go on display in a museum dedicated to the paranormal in Las Vegas. The museum is also owned by Baggins. While on the surface, many of the claims made by members of the Ammons family can be explained away, and have been. For example, many early investigators claimed that the children were simply putting on a show to see if they could fool their mother. The flies on the screen could have many, many possible explanations, and the visions of apparitions, as well as the strange sounds coming from the basement, could all be chalked up to an active imagination or dreams becoming confused with reality. We've all been there. But what sets the Ammons case apart from any other possession story I've come across is the willingness of the press, both local and national, to heavily cover the story as news, as well as the witness statements from government officials who saw one of the young boys behave in a way that defies the laws of our physical world. For that, there hasn't been an explanation yet.
The boy walking up the wall or the levitation. There are photos of things that police saw while they were in the home, but nothing, you know, no demons or paranormal or anything like that.
All right, we'll continue to follow it. Thanks for bringing it to our attention, Marissa. All the best.
Thanks for listening. Make sure you're following The Devil Within wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. You can also check out our socials at The Devil Within Pod on Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook. Until next time, stay safe out there. The Devil Within is a Cloud 10 Media production, recorded live at Bel Air Studios in Los Angeles, California. Written and produced by Brandon Morgan. Executive produced by Sim Sarna. Our post-production supervisor is Bruce Witkin, who also provided original music for this episode. For The Devil Within, I'm your host, Brandon Morgan.